Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we tackle the topic of food and water waste. We begin with Baton Rouge-based food industry veteran Suzanne DePlantis. Her blog, Makeover My Leftover, offers tips on how to transform yesterday's scraps into today's delicious meals.
One of my favorite leftovers is gumbo sloppy joes. And all it takes is the last cup of gumbo that everybody was probably fighting over, and it turns into a meal for the whole family.
Then Michael Hurwitz of Grow NYC joins us to discuss how highly motivated citizens have been working to make composting a regular part of life in New York City.
It is affirmation that farmers markets are test sites. We are community builders.
We're learning to love leftovers on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Another woman is publicly accusing financier Jeffrey Epstein of a sex crime. NBC's Today Show has interviewed a 32-year-old woman who claims that when she was 15, Epstein raped her in his New York mansion. The latest allegations against the multimillionaire are also intensifying scrutiny of the nation's Secretary of Labor, who was a federal prosecutor in Florida over 10 years ago when he oversaw a plea deal that spared Epstein from a possible life sentence for allegedly assaulting dozens of teenage girls. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports Secretary Alexander Acosta will hold a news conference this hour.
Acosta is expected to make a statement on his involvement in Epstein's plea deal. His role in the case came under renewed scrutiny this week after federal prosecutors in New York filed new sex trafficking charges against Epstein. Since then, top congressional Democrats have called on Acosta to step down. On Tuesday, Acosta said he supported the New York prosecutor's decision, even as he defended the decade-old Florida plea agreement that resulted in Epstein just serving 13 months in jail.
That's NPR's Windsor Johnston. Epstein has pleaded not guilty to the current sex trafficking charges. The Justice Department says a new team of attorneys is working on lawsuits to defend the administration's push to get a citizenship question on the 2020 census. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports a federal judge in Maryland is weighing whether to allow lawyers who've been working on the cases for months to leave the case.
The Trump administration has not provided any official reason for why it wants to switch out every single career Justice Department attorney who had been defending efforts to add the question, is this person a citizen of the United States? For the lawsuits over the question based in New York, U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman rejected a request for most of the government's attorneys to withdraw. The judge said the request was patently deficient because it did not follow a local court rule that requires attorneys to give an explanation for leaving a case. Furman's order marks a setback for the Trump administration, which is still working on a way to get a citizenship question on the census after the Supreme Court ruled to keep it off for now. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, New York.
Ukraine's newly elected president has canceled his country's Independence Day parade, saying he will instead allocate funds to military personnel. We have details from NPR's Lucien Kim.
Volodymyr Zelensky, a professional comedian, won a landslide victory in April, promising to change the old-fashioned way of doing politics. In a video posted on his Facebook page, Zelensky said it's time to ditch the military parades his predecessor, Petro Poroshenko, held in Kiev every August 24th.
Всім привіт. Хочу поділитися з вами нашою новою ідеєю.
He called the parades pompous and expensive and said the money would be better spent as bonuses for soldiers. Ukraine has been fighting a low-level war against Russian-backed insurgents for the past 5 years. The Ukrainian military reports that since Monday, 9 servicemen were injured in the combat zone in eastern Ukraine. Lucien Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
This is NPR News. The head of the Federal Reserve is signaling that the central bank may cut interest rates later this month for the first time in 10 years. Fed Chair Jerome Powell is delivering the semi-annual report to Congress. He says the U.S. economic outlook is still affected by uncertainties around trade tensions and concerns about the strength of the global economy. Powell says rising federal budget deficits will eventually push up interest rates. The World Cup champs got their day in the sun today in Lower Manhattan. The U.S. women's national soccer team were honored with a rare ticker tape parade, and as NPR's Colin Dwyer reports, they had plenty of fans to help them celebrate.
Karina Patterson lives in Queens, but even on a work day, she had no doubts about making the trek to see the squad in person.
This is history. This is women's national soccer team. This is history in the making.
Patterson was one of thousands who turned out to see the team make their way to City Hall, where they got keys to the city. On the way, players were showered with confetti and adoration, including from some young soccer players and their moms, who came from New Jersey to give the team a message of their own.
Thanks for inspiring us.
See you in 10 years when you're on the team.
Yeah.
Colin Dwyer, NPR News, New York.
U.S. stocks are higher this hour, with the major market indices up about 0.5% to 0.8%. The Dow's risen 118 points since the open to stand at 26,902. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Babbel, an interactive language program that teaches travel, business, and casual conversation skills in a new language, like Spanish. Available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com.
Join me this week to learn about a 17th century poet who wrote in the style of Robert Burns and whose work influenced the international folk standards Wild Mountain Time and Waltzing Matilda, songs of Robert Tannehill, this week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
Bonjour and hello. Listen to the Franco Mix at 9 p.m. on Thursdays with Drake Benoit LeBlanc, exclusively on KRVS 88.7. Et c'est formidable.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Zatarain's, maker of New Orleans pantry staples like Creole mustard, fish fry, and jambalaya mix. Since 1889. Recipes and more at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Waste not, want not. That's an old piece of wisdom that's never been more true than it is today. Americans throw away shocking amounts of perfectly good food every single day. Frankly, you may as well just throw the money straight into the garbage. But who wants to do that? Not Suzanne DePlantis of Make Over My Leftover. Her blog and Instagram accounts of the same name are helping people waste less and spend less. We sit down with Suzanne to hear some of her inspirational ideas. And then we visit with Lindsay Jean Hard, whose new book is Cooking with Scraps. She's got edible ideas for things we've all thrown away our entire lives, like the water you drain from a can of beans. Wait until you hear this one. And Michael Hurwitz of New York's Green Market joins us with the tale of his inspirational success turning garbage into compost in the Big Apple. Don't take out the garbage, at least not until you hear this week's episode of Louisiana Eats.
Hi, I'm Suzanne DePlantis with Make Over My Leftover. I love using leftovers as startovers to create new meals.
The problems with food waste are so often spoken about in global terms that it's easy to forget they begin with our own refrigerators. Studies have found that the average American tosses out about a pound of food each day. How much did that cost you in 2018? Baton Rouge-based food industry veteran Suzanne DePlantis has made it her mission to help families reduce food waste and save money. Her blog, Make Over My Leftover, gives readers countless ideas on how to transform yesterday's scraps into today's delicious meals. Suzanne joined us in the Louisiana Eat studio to discuss her passion project, which has its roots in her grandmother's philosophy about leftovers.
I grew up as a little girl in the West Bank of New Orleans, and my favorite spot was on the step stool in my meemaw's kitchen. And she was the leftover queen. If there was leftovers from breakfast, it went into lunch, and lunch went into dinner. So she taught me the value and appreciation of food. So that was always with me. And then I had a career in the restaurant industry for 22 years. And seeing my fair share of food waste from the back of the house to the front of the house with the customer's refusal to take to-go box. Then I would ask, would you like a to-go box, say, for the rest of your French fries? And I would get responses like, they're not good cold, or I don't like leftovers. So I found myself grabbing the box anyway and writing a little tip on the top of the box saying, if you bring these French fries home, you could have potato pancakes in the morning, or different options like that. And I found more people started to take home their to-go boxes. So I was inspired by that.
Is that really sort of the place where you started to think of it career-wise?
Not at all. I love the restaurant industry. It was my heart and soul. And tragically, I suffered a stroke. So I had to get out of the restaurant industry. And for the first year through my rehabilitation, part of it, I had to sit and I cut a green bell pepper. And it took me an hour to cut that green bell pepper. So that's a lot of time to look at that bell pepper on the inside of it and the seeds and think about the farmers growing that pepper and the value of food. So not being in the restaurant industry, I was pretty much going stir crazy. What can I do? What can I do? And my husband, who's a minister, reminded me, you know, when you worked at the restaurant, food waste bothers you. You'd come home and complain about the bags of trash being drugged to the dumpster, knowing that 90% of it was food. He said, why don't you do something with that? And it just so happened one of those meant-to-be things. Within a month, I heard the statistic that an average family of four wastes up to $2,200 a year. I started thinking that's a college fund started. That's a vacation that maybe they didn't know they could take. So I started my blog, Makeover My Leftover, with just the hopes of helping one family save food.
How did it grow from there?
It took off tremendously within the first month. I got a call for a segment called Money Mondays about saving money. And that did, you know, prompt me on my journey, so to speak. But at the beginning, I didn't have recipes on my blog. It was a cooking blog with no recipes because I thought if people could just take their leftovers, I'll give them an idea of what to do. But I find that people want to have that initial recipe.
How do you make a recipe without knowing for sure what the leftovers might be, what they might taste like? How do you figure that out?
My mind never stops thinking with food. I think about it all the time. And my motto is to cook is to create. You know, cooking, it's an art form. And that's how I like people to look at it. In fact, on my blog, I have a section called Put Your To Cook Is To Create Thinking Cap On. And so when I do a recipe there, I may say if you have a half a cup of leftover gumbo. One of my favorite leftovers is gumbo sloppy joes. And all it takes is ground meat, 1 pound of ground meat. I add chopped tomatoes to it. And then you're going to add your cup of leftover gumbo in there and let it saute down with the meat and the tomatoes. And then put it on, I like to fill rolls with it, French rolls with it. And it's a gumbo sloppy joe. But I also will give you options on there. Well, if you don't have any gumbo, do you have shrimp bisque, for instance, or do you have chowder? What do you have? Let's look at that. And as far as creating recipes from leftovers, the biggest thing I tell people is to break down that leftover. What is it? For instance, spaghetti and meatballs. Break it down. It's tomatoes. Well, how would you use tomatoes? Can you use that leftover spaghetti like that? Take, for instance, fruitcake. I get a lot of requests of that during the Christmas holidays. You either love it or hate it. I say not to waste it. And it's through questions like that I came up with actually fruitcake granola. So you think fruitcake is nuts, spices, it's dried fruits. What's in granola? All of the above.
You have figured out how to take leftovers and stretch them back from a leftover serving and a half or something until maybe a family for four.
Right. If take spaghetti and meatballs, for instance. You have enough for one person. Well, that's not going to feed your family. But let's take those spaghetti. Let's add a little bit of ricotta cheese to it. Let's go buy some pie crust. And let's make calzones. Now we have enough with that little bit of spaghetti and meatballs that was only going to feed one. Under $5, we have enough now to feed that family of four with that cup. So it's definitely stretching the budget. And if you think about the price of food nowadays, everybody wants to stretch the budget.
It's shocking. You know, I remember back, you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, I would wait for ground beef to go on sale at 99 cents a pound. Now it's kind of a deal if you can find it for $3 a
Absolutely.
Pound.
Absolutely. So we need to get the most out of our meals. And I like to challenge people to a one-week challenge. If you compost, that's awesome. But if not, for the one-week challenge, all the food that you do not eat that would be thrown away, and that includes when you go to lunch and you're spending $18 on a salad, how much are you leaving on that plate? How much money? But save all that food in one bag for a week and then look at that bag. How much food did you waste in the week? It's a visual reminder for us because I think food waste is out of sight, out of mind, and people don't like to think about it. And they don't have to think about it because it's not in their face. But when you're forced for a week to stare at that bag of food, hopefully you'll be thinking a little bit different about it. Think about the farmers, especially here in Louisiana. We know with some of the hardships that our farmers here have had. And look at the produce when you buy the produce. I say that this world of overabundance is slowly killing our world. Because when we go buy produce, we have all this beautiful produce at the stores that are overflowing. We bring it home, and then life gets in the way. We have plans and good intentions to cook, and then we have a late meeting or the children have practice, and it gets forgotten and it gets lost. And so we easily toss it away because we know that we can go to the store the next day and get some more. But what happens if you couldn't?
So what should people do about this problem of everything in the refrigerator that's aging?
I have a few easy tips. One is to run your kitchen just like you would a restaurant kitchen as far as inventories. Keep an inventory sheet. Keep one for your refrigerator, your pantry, and your freezer. I have one on the front of my freezer done by shelf. So I'm actually saving energy because I don't have to open up the freezer and stare at it and wonder what's in there. I know at a glance what I have. And as far as the pantry first in, first out rule, for instance, you know, when you go to the store, make sure everything is rotated. And then also a simple thing is the plate size. The plate sizes have increased so much over the years. And that was something personally that we did in our household was I had these big, beautiful plates that I felt the need for dinner to fill everything up when we had dinner parties and that. And then, of course, people can't eat that much. So just reducing plate size made a difference. In our household. And we talked freezer inventory, make your freezer your BFF because your freezer is there, fresh herbs, everything you have, leftover stock can go in the freezer. And then the important thing is to understand the date labels. Food gets prematurely thrown out due to the date labeling. And so a lot of people think, oh, this is expired, when it's not an expiration date. It's a best by date or a sell by date. Did you know that there's only one product required by the FDA to have an expiration date?
No.
Infant formula. We wouldn't have beautiful salvage stores in the city of New Orleans and cities around the state if it was expired food. It's perfectly good food. It's more about the quality. Those dates are put on there if you have a bag of pork rinds, for instance. The date would be on there, for instance, today. That's guaranteeing you that by today, that's going to be the utmost freshest pork rind, crispiest you can ever have. That doesn't mean tomorrow it's not any good. It doesn't mean the week later it's not any good. And there's some staple items that you should have in your pantry at all times and in your freezer. Always have a protein in your freezer. A bag of frozen shrimp is always in my freezer for a quick go-to. But have your staples in Louisiana. We love our beans. We love our rice, pasta, and have just those items that you know you can throw together really quick. If you have a flour tortillas, quesadillas are super easy for leftovers that you may have.
So you have been at this for how long?
It will be going on 5 years.
And about how many recipes have you created for people to make their leftovers?
You know, it's surprising. I'm working on my first cookbook, and I had no idea I had so many recipes that I did because I never wrote my recipes down. I just cooked. I cook from the heart, and that's what I do. And writing them down, really keeping a tally, oh my goodness, I needed 100 for my cookbook, and I, well, easily or up into probably about the 400 mark.
Oh my goodness.
On leftovers. So if you have a leftover question, I always tell my readers, you can message me or contact me saying, oh, help me, help me. I have a cup of this left, what to do with it. Nobody wants to eat it anymore in my house. And I'm more than happy to offer some advice.
Well, I hope we've got everybody at home inspired to save money, save food, save the world, just one apple core at a time, maybe.
You got that right. And that apple core makes a great tea. It also makes a great glaze, too. So don't be tossing out the apple core.
Thank you, Suzanne. It was such a pleasure to meet you.
A dream come true. Thank you, Poppy.
Suzanne Duplantis of Makeover My Leftover.
Don't throw your love away. No, 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 no. Don't throw your love away. For you might need it someday.
Coming up next, we continue to take a hard look at how to get the most out of our culinary throwaways. Lindsay Jean Hard, author of Cooking with Scraps, joins us when Louisiana Eats returns in a moment.
Lovers love today, just throw their dreams away and play and love. They give their love away to anyone who said, I love you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bill Bolins from the Dirty Rice Show. Dirty Rice is on the air every Saturday evening from 9 p.m. until 11 p.m. So won't you join either myself or my co-host, Mr. Lee Kleinpeter,
for the best in Louisiana music, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM and on the internet at krvs.org.
Later today on This American Life, what it is like in Iowa right now. This place that's crawling with, what is it, 25 presidential candidates?
It does look like Beto, you're right.
That guy?
Yeah.
I think it's him.
Oh, that is him. Isn't it surreal? Just like when you're walking through a small town, you're like, oh, that guy ran for president.
This strange, crowded, early moment in this election.
Coming up tonight at 7 here on KRVS.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter, dishing up 200 years of history, refreshing Pimm's Cup cocktails, and toasty warm muffaladas. All-day dining and private events at 500 Charter Street.
My name is Lindsay Jean Hard. I'm the author of Cooking with Scraps. Turn your peels, cores, rinds, and stems into delicious meals.
Energized by her membership in a Japanese CSA, that's community-supported agricultural farm, Lindsay Jean Hard began to wonder how she would make use of all the fresh produce she was receiving, especially the scraps. Her curiosity about uses for throwaways like peels, cores, and rinds inspired her to search for recipes and experiment on her own. In her book, Cooking with Scraps, Lindsay Jean shares her discoveries, presenting a reference guide for zero-waste cooking.
When we spoke by phone, I began by asking her how she became so partial to underutilized produce parts.
Well, it was kind of a roundabout journey. I really got more into food and writing when my husband and I were living in Japan for a couple of years. And he and I joined a CSA there for the first time ever. And so that meant that we were getting a box every week of produce that had been grown by local farmers. And, you know, in addition to it being a new exploration for me of fruits and vegetables that I'd never seen or cooked with before, it was like a really poignant moment for me of connecting with where my food was coming from, because I was thinking more about the farmers that were growing this nearby, and I really wanted to respect and honor the food and use all of what I was getting. And then eventually, after coming back and helping friends create a startup that was all about connecting to where your food was coming from, I started working for food52.com, a food and lifestyle website. And I wore a number of different hats there as well, but I wrote a couple of different columns, and one of them was cooking with scraps. And I would search through the recipe archives, because that's a community-built website where anyone can upload recipes. And I would look for ones where community members had made smart use of underutilized produce parts and other odds and ends. And I would feature them. And I learned so much in that process that then I wanted to share that knowledge with a broader audience.
I loved your writing. I'm really a big fan. And you mention your time in Japan in the book. And the Japanese have their own very interesting concept of waste not, want not, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It's a couple of different Japanese phrases that really stuck with me and helped motivate this book. But the one that you're referring to is motenai. And in some ways, it's not all that different from waste not, want not. But their version manages to capture, like, not only the shame in wasting the precious resource, but it also holds on to the gratitude for what a gift that was in the first place, whether it's food or something else entirely.
It was so inspirational to me to read that really one of your motivations is to change the food system from your own kitchen. You know, sometimes this problem seems bigger than all of us, but to get it down to your own home kitchen, because 40% of U.S. food goes uneaten. How can that be?
I know. I mean, it's just a really staggering number. And, you know, it really does start in our own kitchens. There's a lot that we all can be doing, and that really does make a difference when it's collective action with all of us coming together.
What are some of your best recommendations for people who want to change the food system from their kitchen?
I recommend not getting overwhelmed and just starting small, because it is true, once you think about that and realize how big the problem is, it's easy to get overwhelmed. But that's not going to help anyone if we're overwhelmed and just, you know, don't bother cooking with them to begin with. So if you just choose like one scrap or two scraps that you haven't been using to start cooking with, whether it's stale bread or broccoli stems or corn cobs, and if you start putting those to use and work them into your repertoire and really get comfortable, then just keep adding in more as you go, and you'll get more and more comfortable, and they'll just become more like any other ingredient, and you won't start to see them as scraps anymore.
Well, I don't think a lot of people have any great ideas about what to do with apple and pear peels or cores. What are some of the things that you recommend people do?
Well, peels are a really fun one. I like to make flavored salts and sugars with them. So you can dehydrate those peels, like tomato peels, pear peels, and plum peels, just in the lowest setting on your oven, or, of course, if you have a food dehydrator, that works too. And then I'm just combining them in a food processor with salt or sugar, and you end up with these really flavorful salts and sugars that have lovely colors too, and they just add a lot of visual interest and flavor to things that you're making.
Your book absolutely, if I can say so, really kind of bent my brain. How in the world did you ever come to think a banana peel should go in a cake?
Well, I don't know when it was that I first learned that they're edible, but that was really a mind-blowing thing to me, too. I had had no idea and, you know, had never thought of that. And I think that's a lot of people's feelings. We just don't realize at all that they're edible. And so my first thought once I realized that was I should make banana bread that doesn't have any bananas in it. I don't know about you, but I have had trouble finding my one perfect banana bread recipe. Like I find one and I'm like, oh, it should be a little more this, a little more that. And so I didn't have a good starting place, but my grandmother has made this banana cake for all of my life. It's my favorite banana cake recipe. And so I thought that that would be a great starting point for me to try using banana peels in a cake. And it's delicious. It's moist. It has a great texture. And you'd never know there's no bananas in it at all. It's just the peels.
How do you process the peels to get them edible? Because they're so fibrous.
Yeah, well, so for the cookbook, I have you chop them up and cook them a little bit in water to soften them and then blend that all together. In the past couple of months, I've continued experimenting with this. And I found that you can also freeze the bananas whole and then peel them, and the peels soften a lot from going through that freezing and thawing, and so it makes them even easier to work with. So that's another option, too.
Okay, true confession. We drink a lot of coffee down here in New Orleans, and yes, I have seen a pork loin rubbed in coffee grinds to be roasted, but I haven't really seen a lot of recipes that include coffee grinds, much less used coffee grinds. Now, what's up with that?
Yeah, used coffee grounds still contain so much of that coffee flavor. There are just a number of ways that you can be putting them to good use. In the book, I'm using them in a nut butter because you'll get that coffee flavor, but you also get a great little crunchy texture in the nut butter. And then on Food 52, you can also find a recipe for a French silk pie where I've used those grounds a couple of different ways. I'm using them to infuse cream to make a whipped cream topping for the pie. And then I'm also using them straight up in the crust of the pie along with some crushed chocolate cookies. So it's a nice chocolate coffee blend of flavors.
We are big bean eaters down here. You know, it's red beans and rice every Monday. And in your book, I discover an ingredient I've never even known of before. Tell me about that magical ingredient you discovered.
It is a magical ingredient. So you're talking about aquafaba, and that's the name for the cooking liquid from beans and other legumes. And you can definitely use that liquid from soaking and cooking your own dried beans. If you haven't worked with aquafaba before, though, I would recommend starting with the liquid from canned beans.
Why?
It's just sometimes it can be a little bit of a tricky ingredient, and I found it more consistently works and whips up for you if you're using the liquid from canned beans. And that's what's fun about this ingredient. It whips up just like egg whites do. And so you can use it a lot of the same ways that you'd use egg whites. So in the cookbook, I'm using them to make brownies, and I'm also using them to make a mayonnaise.
So it can go sweet or savory. This is really blowing my mind.
Yeah, it's really fun. It does taste slightly beany, so you could use it like straight up to make meringues, like something similar to, you know, an egg white-based meringue. In that case, you would probably want to be adding flavor, like cocoa powder or matcha powder, along with sugar to help mask that beany flavor a little bit. But when you're using it, like, in place of eggs, like in the brownies, for example, that beany flavor does not come through.
Now, is there anything that you've ever said, oh, my goodness, this is relegated to the garbage?
Well, I've been on a mission. There's a recipe on Food 52 for broccoli stalks that treat them sort of like bones, and it's cooking to them to the point where you're scooping out the inside like marrow from a bone. And I really wanted to be able to do that with broccoli, with Brussels sprout stalks, but those are just so tough and woody and fibrous that I have yet to be able to use the Brussels sprout stock. But someone suggested trying a pressure cooker, so that might be what it takes to figure out how to use that one.
Lindsay Jean, I love your book, and I hope everybody checks out your work on Food 52 and starts turning all of their normally compostable bits and pieces into yummy, yummy, edible things. I'm going to go home tonight and finish out the last of that jar of strawberry preserves with some balsamic vinegar. That sounds like a delicious salad dressing.
Oh, perfect. I hope you enjoy it, and thank you so much for having me.
That was Lindsay Jean Hard, author of Cooking with Scraps. Turn your peels, cores, rinds, and stems into delicious meals.
So if you find someone who gives you all of the love, take it to your heart, don't let it stray. Oh, one thing for certain, you will surely be a-hurtin' if you throw it all away. If you throw it all away.
According to the USDA, Americans waste over 373 million pounds of food every day. In New York City, roughly a third of this waste stream is organic material that can be composted. The process of breaking down garbage and returning it back into the environment. Composting is not a new concept to the Big Apple, but over the past 10 years, it's become even easier for residents to recycle. Michael Hurwitz is the director of the Green Market, a program of Grow NYC that operates 53 farmers markets throughout the five boroughs of New York City. He explained to us how groups of highly motivated citizens have been working to make composting a regular part of life in New York.
My name is Michael Hurwitz. I am the Green Market Director at Grow NYC in New York City. I became the director at Green Market 11 and a half years ago, and I started on the same day that a sister program was started dedicated to teaching New Yorkers how to recycle. So I had a partner named David Hurd, who is the director of that program. And we began really looking at how our markets could be centered of sustainability. There were two markets that we had, one which was Union Square, where there was another nonprofit called the Lower East Side Ecology Center, Christina Datz Romero, who had been working on recycling issues in New York City for the last 40 years, week in, week out, collecting food scraps at Union Square and going to processing it on her site along the East River in Manhattan. And that was a funded nonprofit. And then at our Fort Greene Market in Brooklyn, there were these three community gardeners that would set up every Saturday and ask for food scraps that they could take back to their community garden. And when I got there, I approached them and I said, how can we help? And they said, we need $500 to build a trike so that we can actually bike this stuff back to our gardens. So we wrote them a check and said, great. And that began to take off. So the trike was 2008. And as that grew, they said to me and to David, we've exceeded our capacity. This actually needs to be real now. It's volunteer-based. We're losing the energy of some of our volunteers. So what can you do to help us? And we got a grant from then Speaker of City Council, Christine Quinn, who gave us a grant for us to begin collecting food scraps, renting our own trucks, hiring our own staff to stand on the street corner and collect food scraps at four individual markets. And then collect them each day, and then we would deliver them to three community gardens in Brooklyn. And now we're at 2011. You have to be willing to fail and to struggle if you're going to get to the next level. And so we do that all the time. On the same week, we launched our Fresh Bodega initiative, which failed miserably, but whose lessons we learned, so we started our own distribution arm from the lessons that we learned from that project. and we started our compost collection at Market. So we drove around, starting at four markets, collecting in garbage bags with a little bit of money, trying to figure it out. And what we demonstrated pretty quickly is that New Yorkers will freeze their food scraps or raise fruit flies on their windowsills like I do. And we will collect our food scraps and bring them to markets. We'll bring it on the subway. We'll bring it by foot. We'll bring it by car, by bike, you name it. Give us the opportunity, and this is what we want to do. So we began to expand to more and more markets. People would actually pay us. They would give us volunteer suggested donations, like hundreds and hundreds of dollars each week, for the privilege of them being able to drop off their compost. One of the things that we did with compost is we tried to sell finished product. Again, failed miserably. The logistics, the staffing, the costs, it was essentially impossible to do it effectively and efficiently at Green Market and at Grow NYC. Fortunately, we have an ED that allows us to fail and that isn't afraid to a funder to say, we didn't quite hit these targets, but this is what we learned and this is what we're going to implement. So after several years of expanding this program to more and more markets, we finally hit about 22 markets. The Department of Sanitation, as only they can in New York City, they said, that's our garbage, that's not your garbage. So they began to fund their employees and their trucks collecting from our markets each week. So our staff still picks up from, I think, 12 individual markets, and sanitation is picking up from another 30. Most of this is going to community compost sites, process it, and then it gets reintroduced to city parks, community gardens throughout the five boroughs. It has led to the city having a goal of 8 million New Yorkers having either in their own buildings or within like a quarter mile distance from their homes organic food collection. It is affirmation that farmers markets are where we are test sites, we are community builders, we are pure example, you know, the age-old cliche of never underestimate the power of a group of highly motivated individual citizens, right? Because literally what this group of three community composters demonstrated each week is coming to their community town square, which was the Fort Greene Green Market. They were able to demonstrate that they could motivate their neighbors to divert, I think 40% of our waste stream is organic matter, divert what is otherwise gorgeous black gold that can be turned into soil, that can then help grow foods in our communities and get more New Yorkers engaged in community gardening, and then demonstrate to, like, this was the pilot that demonstrated to the city of what we can do. So I'm incredibly proud. I love the fact that our sister program and our organization, that we are more than just about running farmers markets per se, and that we are associated with a group of individuals that are spending, you know, working tirelessly to train all of our neighbors and all of our communities why this matters, how to do it, and then making it possible to do it.
That was Michael Hurwitz, Green Market Director at Grow NYC in New York City.
Oh, I love trash. Anything dirty or dingy or dusty. Anything ragged or rotten or rusty. Yes, I love trash. If you really want to see something trashy, look at this. I have here a sneaker that's tattered and worn.
What else can you do with a peach pit besides throw it away? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
I love trash.
I'm Cecil Doyle. Since the latter part of the 1980s, Earthbeat has been spotlighting sounds from around the world, from field recordings to classic vinyl to some of the latest smashes on the international scene. Join us for Earthbeat, Sundays 7 to 8 p.m., Thursdays 10 to 11 p.m., right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Hello, KRVS listeners. We now have a unique program, K-Pop Vivi, that offers K-Pop music. This is the only K-Pop program on air in Louisiana. K-Pop Vivi with David Kim. Every Monday night at midnight, here on KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette Lake Charles.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Our drag queen brunch craze continues with the tales of the cocktail brunch at Toujac's Restaurant on Sunday, July 21st. For reservations and more information, contact Katie at toujacs.com or call 504-358-4905. And then, help our friend, the one and only Amanda Toops, yes, that's Isaac's wife, celebrate her 40th birthday with a charity brunch at Toops South on Sunday, July 28th. Call Toops South at 504-304-2147 and reserve your seat to say happy birthday, Amanda. The food will be delicious. The queens will be lovely. The mimosas are bottomless. And remember, all of my Poppy's pop-up drag brunches benefit the Food for Friends program at Crescent Care and are appropriate for the whole family. So join us for a rollicking good time and do good while having some summertime fun. For more details, visit poppytooker.com. And now, back to Louisiana Eats.
Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. What else can you do with a peach pit besides throw it away? Actually, all stone fruit pits can be cracked, yielding a tiny kernel with a very strong almond flavor. In fact, some brands of amaretto are made with them. Here's the crazy thing, though. They actually contain a small amount of cyanide, and eating a small handful could give you a stomachache or worse. So what does Lindsay Jean Hard recommend? She recommends using Alice Waters' method of roasting the kernels for a brief time, which eliminates the harmful substance. Then, using vodka and simple syrup, she crafts her own version of what the French call crème de noyau. You see, the French even have a special name for those small stone fruit kernels. They call them noyau. So, the next time you make a fresh peach pie, get cracking on those pits. You'll find Lindsay Jean's recipe on our website at poppytooker.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Elliot Sherman, and I am an environmental scientist.
For Elliot Sherman, water is an issue that flows through all areas of our lives. He works for the Environmental Protection Agency, a job that brought him to New Orleans to spread the word about conservation. Here in Louisiana, we know quite well that living with water can be a constant struggle.
Elsewhere, Americans are dealing with the opposite problem, experiencing annual droughts and wildfires that cause other serious hardships. Elliot stopped by our studio during his visit, and I asked him to share his view on water conservation and its connection to the food and beverage industry.
It's an integral part of society, part of our economy, a lot of people don't think about it, you know, when they, you know, wash their clothes, brush their teeth, flush the toilet, where that water's coming from, where that water goes, how much it costs to get it to you clean, what it costs to treat it afterwards. And it's a scarce resource in a lot of parts of the country, as we see in the news more and more lately. So it's something that's worth bringing more to the forefront, discussing, figuring out ways that we can conserve, new technologies to reuse water, things like that.
And it's not just in the U.S. Water is an enormous issue on the entire planet, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I actually did my graduate work in the Middle East, where water's been a huge problem for many years. So they've been on the forefront of new technologies, treating saline water, desalinating ocean water to make drinking water. So it's a big issue everywhere, obviously. A lot of places in Africa, the developing world, don't have any. You know, they're digging wells in their backyard. So yeah, it's a big issue everywhere that finally in the U.S., you know, we're starting to see that we don't really have that much either. So
what are some of the desperate measures that you see people taking to get potable water?
It's desperate in a lot of places in the world. You know, sub-Saharan Africa is a great example, but women will walk hours a day just to get one barrel of water to bring to their families. And that's time that they could be spending in school, getting education. And, you know, traditionally in a lot of societies in Africa, it's the women who would get the water for their families. So, you know, they're having to walk further and further, local wells that aren't dug deep enough or drying up. And so they're needing to dig more wells, and that can affect the groundwater. And with contamination, you know, you might have used to had a water source near your house that's no longer clean. Internationally, I mean, those are some of the problems in the developing world. Luckily, there's some NGOs trying to help, you know, with those wells and educate and, you know, provide the opportunity for these women to not have to walk so far. And then, you know, that kind of spirals. But that's certainly one. I mentioned the Middle East earlier, but even with developed societies in the Middle East, they don't have water resources other than to desalinate from the ocean. And that's very expensive. It takes a lot of energy currently. So it's not quite a solution just yet.
When we look at the industry that our Louisiana Eats listeners are most likely involved in, which is the hospitality industry, whether it's the restaurant or the bar, what are some measures that people should be considering?
Yeah, that's a great question. And bars and restaurants have this great opportunity to be a source of education for their patrons. And, you know, if you can, as a bar owner or a restaurant owner, you know, take a look at what you're doing, how you're running your operation and say, oh, this, you know, I could get this lower flow toilet and I could save, you know, 20-30% of my water use, or I could train my bartender a little bit differently and use a little bit less ice on every single drink I make, you know, and over the course of a night and a week and a month and a year, that can save thousands of gallons. You know, that can have a big impact. And if your patrons see that, then maybe they go home and think, oh, maybe I'll turn off the faucet when I'm brushing my teeth, or, you know, I won't run the dishwasher when it's half full. I think it can kind of spread from there. So
let's talk about water reuse. You know, most of us use water and it just washes down the drain. What are your thoughts about how we can conserve through reuse?
Well, water use is something I'm pretty passionate about. I studied it and very interested in. I think it's a great solution. As you mentioned, you know, water goes down the drain. We don't really know what happens. So traditionally, that would be treated, you know, at your treatment plant to a clean enough degree that it could be put back into your river. And then to make drinking water, it would have to be taken out again, treated again. And that's all, you know, when you think about it holistically, it's energy, it's time, it's, you know, burning coal to make power, things like that. But with reuse, you can kind of look at it more as a resource. So you can take that water, treat it to such a degree that you can use it for irrigating. You can use it in public, you know, sprinklers or fountains, things like that. So instead of having to dump it back into a stream, you can use it one more time, essentially. Another example would be like a gray water system. We call it gray water basically any water that's not sewage. So within your household, you could use that water from your washing machine to flush your toilets. That can add up to a huge amount of water that you don't need to be using fresh that you can use one more time. And so it's an energy savings, it's a resource savings. And in places like out west where they're dealing with drought and constrained resources, it really adds up. So there's places that are reusing 80-90% of their water in the world currently. So we're getting there here as well. But
that's very ambitious. I, you know, here in Louisiana, New Orleans, we're 7 feet under sea level. I don't really see anybody going to the gray water level. And I don't know how you get that message to those people.
Yeah, I think it's slow to catch on sometimes. I know out west, it was something that there was no other option really when droughts started to happen more frequently. When you're in an area like down here in Louisiana where you're right on the water or in the Great Lakes, you don't necessarily think about it. But when you look at water as a resource that takes energy as well, and everything that's included in that, then you can start to see that no matter how much water is around your city, it's still worthwhile to take advantage of implementing resource measures and infrastructure, things like that.
How can people look for this guidance? Where can they find the word on what they can do to help this problem?
Sure. Well, a great place to start is with your city. Reach out, whatever phone number's on your water bill, give them a call, go online. It's easy to Google, what city you're living in the water, and they'll have probably resources of their own. There's great federal programs out there as well. So just as an example, WaterSense is a federal program that certifies appliances that are low flow or really efficient. So you can go and get a list of those and see, what's a better product to use, how much it saves. And again, if you're a restaurant or a bar, that really does affect your bottom line. That's one thing that we're doing is providing those resources that might not be familiar to people if they reach out. And if you're doing it on your own, start locally and go from there. There's also a lot more consulting happening now in the bar and restaurant industry. So there's bartenders that are aware of this and concerned about it. So they're talking to their fellow bartenders, and some of them have came and discussed with me, and I'm consulting with them. It's kind of spiraling, and hopefully that chatter will spread. And so, then when a patron comes into a bar that might not be doing any conservation and says, "What are you doing to save water or energy?" They can then turn to, their fellow bartenders or look online and find out what they can do.
Well, I'm really thrilled to have had this opportunity to talk with you on Louisiana Eats. And sometimes it's Louisiana Eats and Drinks. And today it's we'll drink some water. So let's drink to that.
Cheers.
Thank you, Elliot.
Thanks so much.
That was Elliot Sherman, water scientist at the EPA. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions and hear all about upcoming special events by visiting poppytooker.com. You can find videos, recipes, and even order cookbooks there. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from Camellia Brand Beans. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef and Louisiana Wagyu in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.
For the best Cajun, Creole, and French music, listen to me, Noel Jules, every Sunday afternoon from 12 noon to 3 of